But yeah, ultimately, it's whatever gets exposed gets one atom on it, and then the process shuts itself off after a single monolayer. And that tactical advantage of my battery lasts longer, or it's safer, or I can have more power, all of that is absolutely critical in those markets, and those are your first adopters.
I didn't realize that what you do enables batteries to be that much better and chips to be that much more powerful.
No, early on there would be, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. I remember going straight at that for about 4 months, and then I said, I got to take a day off.
This is the ProCo 360 podcast for people who love Colorado and love hearing from Colorado's most inventive and successful entrepreneurs. Today's guest is Paul Lichty of Forge Nano. Paul started with an idea that the University of Colorado's own tech transfer office said, we're not so sure we want that. So he bought the rights for $1 and started building in his Westminster garage. What he's built is now one of the world's leading atomic layer deposition companies. And what is that? We'll talk about that. And here's the idea, though. Imagine coating a material one single atom at a time. Maybe not one at a time, but one thick. We'll get into that. He's creating a layer so thin it's invisible and so precise it transforms how materials perform. Forge Nano does this at an industrial scale, making batteries last longer, semiconductors perform better, and all kinds of advanced materials stronger and more durable. They've raised over $100 million from investors like GM, Volkswagen, and LG, and they're doing it right here in Colorado. So, Paul, welcome to ProCo 360.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and I told Paul coming into this interview, like, these are really challenging for me when I don't understand nanophysics, particle, whatever, like, these are tough. So I prep and I walk in ignorant. So I gave an intro, help us understand better what Forge Nano does.
Yeah. I mean, it's a, without going too far into the physics and the chemistry, it's a process that allows us to do perfect coatings and kind of perfect manipulation of matter. And that's part of what was attractive to me learning about this going through school is it's the best way that we have the science and physics available to us to build things. And I always love building things. And so you can't pass up the perfect process for building materials.
Well, building them one atom at a time. Okay, so for a layperson, why do we have to be able to coat things so precisely as to like an atom thick?
Well, it really gets into having the maximum capability. So for instance, when we coat materials that go in lithium ion batteries, we're putting a protective coating on, and that's important. But if you get too thick, you can't have the lithium ion transport. So you lose the conductivity. So there's always this trade-off with thickness and performance, and that's where a perfect coating process or an atomic level process unlocks more capabilities than you would have otherwise available.
And is this really a single atom thick?
Yeah.
So like I'm picturing that there was this video made a few years ago where IBM had somehow managed to manipulate atoms into the IBMs. Like, you can do that?
It, more or less, the function is of the chemistry is to do one atom thick on everything. So it starts with a really reactive, what we call a precursor, and that just bonds with every single available surface. Now, there are ways to pattern. There are ways to mask so that you can start doing that with a lot more control. But yeah, ultimately, it's whatever gets exposed gets one atom on it, and then the process shuts itself off after a single monolayer.
Wow. But now, I don't know anything about this stuff, but atoms can't actually sit next to each other. Can they? They have some natural spacing, right?
Mm-hmm. So it depends on what we do with it. Single atoms deposition, their positioning is controlled by what we call the ligands that stay attached to it. So it'll come, and I'm using my hands here.
He's using his hands here. Yeah.
But if you imagine, atoms attached to this umbrella of other molecules that allow them to be in the gas phase, land on the surface, and then that umbrella keeps them from getting too close together or bonding, and it really is what shuts off the whole rest of the surface from doing more than a monolayer.
All right. So is there any way for someone like me to understand how this process works?
I like to use the analogy with Lego. You know, everybody has, I've got kids, they love Lego. But the really fun part about that toy is after you've built the things and then take it apart, what they can do with just discrete building blocks, putting it together to build something really amazing. Both my kids have built things that I don't think I could reverse engineer, just coming right out of their imagination. And that's what gets unlocked with how we're able to do this atom by atom. For making materials. There's a lot of applications that we haven't even discovered or that people are working on in universities across the world using this technique, which unlocks that ability to be creative and use your imagination to build whatever surface you want.
So when you were back at CU in the lab, what year were you when you started working on this stuff?
I started working in my undergrad, maybe my junior year. So I was about 20 years old, and that would have been 2024, 2025.
Okay.
Sorry, 2004, 2005.
Okay. Oh, okay. Got it. All right. So because the company started in 2011.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So one more dumb layperson question, then I'm just going to give up. But I mean, when you're in a lab and somebody says, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could make single layer atoms line something, right? And then the question says, well, yeah, it'd be cool, but how do we do it? So what at a macro level is happening when guys like you say, hey, how do we make that happen?
Well, I mean, we lucked out and really stood on the shoulders of giants, if you will. This process was developed probably 60 years ago. And so when I entered into the lab and started learning about something that we were using mostly from a R&D standpoint, if we wanted to make a new catalyst, rather than getting your chemistry set out and trying to figure out how to synthesize it and get it on the substrate and purify it, there were all these molecules that have been known that create this monolayer that we could just buy and put them in our specialized reactor to make the product that we were looking to make. It's kind of like 3D printing with atoms.
Got it. So now I'm starting to put it together because the real secret sauce for Forge Nano is not that you know how to do this, but that you can do it quickly, that you can do it as part of a production process that makes it practical now going forward, right? Talk about that.
Yeah. As you can imagine, if you're going to build something atom by atom, it can take a really long time.
Yeah.
And that's where it's been kind of a process of last resort for industries like the semiconductor, where transistors have shrunk down now. They're 7 atoms thick, the dielectric gaps. So you have no other option than controlling things down atom by atom. And the main issue by taking this and applying it to every other product you can imagine has been scale. The speed and the pricing and the magnitude that you can achieve by doing this. And that's really what we developed was just processes, equipment, sometimes specialized different components that allowed us to take this to the next level where the costs of doing this become oftentimes cheaper than what they're currently doing.
Okay. And in a minute, we're going to go into the two main product lines. You're focused on batteries and chips. But first, I'm intrigued by this brand name that you have called Atomic Armor. That's a cool name. And in any other world, it wouldn't really mean atomic armor. It would mean some kind of a fitness drink or clothing or something. So how'd you come up with this? It's pretty cool.
Yeah, we were several drinks in with some investors of mine actually on Pearl Street and just trying to think of how to take what is, as you've identified, a complex technical product. And even, you know, saying atomic layer deposition is a mouthful. That's usually when I see investors' eyes roll back into their, you know, to the back of their head, because there's just a lot going on there. How do we summarize this into something that conveys what it is we do very succinctly? And we came up with most of where we apply our coatings is protection. And, you know, it's atomic armor.
Cool. All right. And I want to go back a little bit because is it true that I mean, so many good ideas come out of University of Colorado, engineering and so forth. They can't take them all. But this is one that they passed on. And you bought for, is it true you bought it for a dollar and now you've raised, you know, you've got an over much, well over $1 billion valuation. Is that all true?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's some caveats there. We do still have CU on our cap table based on some in-licensing of IP and other transactions that happened
since we started. That's good.
But so, yeah, the buffs are going to benefit from what we're doing.
Good.
And we're happy to see that. But yeah, originally, the original IP around a scaled up process, they passed and we had kind of hit a deadline with when you have to submit to the patent office and you have to provide action. And so it was going to cost money. And we said, all right, we'll get the money out of our pockets. We'll hire the lawyer and we'll move the thing forward.
So this is where some of these things just die. If they don't have enough momentum and someone isn't willing to invest in the patent, they just they don't necessarily die, but someone could take it.
Yeah. Yeah. Once you disclose to the patent office, you have a provisional period.
Yeah. Like a year or something.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. And then you kind of have to, you get feedback, but you have to continue to pay the legal and the filing fees, et cetera, to get a real patent finally issued.
Okay. But now when you started this back, I mentioned in 2011, you were designing what was going to be a technology to unlock production for products that hadn't actually become invented particularly well at that time. I mean, mm-hmm. for lithium ion batteries, they weren't a thing then, or they weren't much of a thing. Same with the kind of neat, I mean, chips, of course, were there, but not these multi-dimensional teeny, teeny chips. Like, so did you know this was coming or did you just like the technology?
It's kind of a little bit of both. We see it as an inevitable step if we're going to continue to make better and better products. Anything you can think of eventually will get to a point where you're unlocking additional performance or reduced costs or new capabilities by having the capabilities of, you know, building it atom by atom. That's just kind of fundamental.
In 2011, it became obvious that at some point it was going to get so small it was going to be atomic layer production?
I mean, that's the natural course of things. If you look at Moore's Law, everything is shrinking in order to keep up with the number of transistors and more. You hit this fundamental limit, which is a single atom. We don't have the ability to put down half atoms.
Not yet. Do you think that's in 50 years, are they going to look back and think we're prehistoric? And
I mean, like I said, that goes beyond my physics know-how. Yeah. There may be some things that come up, but I think there's so much white space still in what we do. Unlocking new capabilities, new technologies, anything that is really outside of a semiconductor product is that uses atomic layer deposition is enabled via our equipment and capabilities. And that's a pretty neat place to be.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about both of your main product focuses. By battery, is that accurate? Batteries on one hand, chips on the other hand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So complete this sentence. Before Forge Nano, lithium batteries could only be made such and such. Now, this is the outcome.
Sure. Before Forge Nano, lithium ion batteries suffered from all these side reactions that cause your phone to die after 2 years and your electric vehicle to lose range. When you protect the materials, what we're really doing is just shutting down all the unwanted reactions or slowing down the unwanted reactions and enabling the ones you want, which is just lithium going back and forth.
Wow.
If there were no side reactions, your batteries could last forever.
So manufacturers must hate you. You're making batteries last longer. You're making phones last longer. You're making car like.
There are markets that do not appreciate a longer lasting battery.
Yeah.
That's for sure. But that's also why, you know, our go-to-market strategy has been around the marketplaces like defense, aerospace, satellites, where longer lifetime adds a significant amount of value.
That makes sense. And I could think, though, that there'd be some markets that are like, yeah, we don't need to pay more for this. That actually hurts us. Although that didn't work so well for Kodak. It didn't work for others, right? But because you can, I mean, sheltering yourself, your customers from a better product probably isn't a good long end game.
That's how we think.
Yeah,
You know, we want everybody to make products that can last forever and maintain value. But yeah, we have a certain consumer culture that doesn't always line up with it.
Okay, so finishing on the battery piece, if a battery would have lasted 2 years with normal use, if they've been built using your technology, how long could they last?
So we've done the head-to-head with things like cell phone batteries. It's at least 4 to 5 years. We have a product that was on one of our satellite missions that actually after 3 years, there was no degradation.
Wow.
And so we don't know how long that was going to keep going or if something else was going to cause that degradation. But our ability to protect the product, and you can either exchange that for longer lifetime or more rigorous abuse, fast charging, or you can unlock more of the lithium that's in it and get more energy density.
That's pretty amazing. You also then would have a profound impact ultimately on landfill usage, disposal of all these kinds of things that people are like, what are we doing with these? Wow.
And even in recyclability, we've worked with companies that do recycling and we've shown that we protect the underlying material. Now, the lithium comes out of, let's say, your cathode and it goes back and forth and it can get lost in the battery a lot of different ways. But the underlying cathode material, when we coat it, is protected. So you can just relithiate it and it goes right back up to 100%, which for conventional recycling right now, you have to take it all the way back down to the base metals.
Wow.
You have to rebuild the cathode material and then make it again.
I've never heard the term relithiate. But here we go. All right. So I want to ask you about the chip technology because mm-hmm. that's even more profound. But first, I want to take a quick break and remind listeners, this is ProCo 360, named Best Colorado Business Podcast since 2021. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. This is the podcast for people who love Colorado and the stories of Colorado businesses and entrepreneurs. My guest today is Paul Lichty of Forge Nano. I want to thank our sponsors. These guys are great. I appreciate them. Via Technologies, they host ProCo 360 and they're a great help at keeping the website up and running. They are building a growing business by working closely with really smart clients to partner on achieving client growth using web-based technology and digital marketing. Also, my friends at Denver Ventures, we stay in touch and we partner to feature some great Colorado growth stories as well. All right, so I want to switch now to chips because to me you're enabling AI to do some things, AI chip makers to do some things that they never could do before. So talk about that.
Yeah, the semiconductor industry is really the first commercial industry to start using atomic layer deposition. And that only started about 15 years ago in earnest for high production because, again, it's kind of a process of last resort. And then when you have to get 7 atoms, you need to use, very precise processes. But what we did with our experience coding things like particles or high surface area objects, we were able to take that high throughput innovation, apply it back to semiconductors. So now we can do the same ALD as everybody else, but we do it much faster and we can do it at that speed with very high, what I'll call aspect ratio features. So if you think of really tiny straws, in order to get your atoms all the way to the end of that straw to react and coat can take a very long time via conventional ALD. We've innovated ways to drive that much faster. So what we highlight in some of our press releases, we talk about aspect ratio. And the current state of the art is probably a 10-to-1 aspect ratio. So a straw with a diameter that's 1/10 of its length. We've been able to show 1,000-to-1 aspect ratio at high speed. And so what this means is the ALD step is no longer the bottleneck in your total fab process, and you can make much smaller features. And so for things like AI, it's not so much how many transistors you can put on there. It gets down to the advanced packaging and your ability to conduct in an overall chiplet between the processing, the memory, the sensors, rather than conducting electrons. The analogy we use is driving to your friend's house across the neighborhood. There's tiny little wires that have to conduct there and you get losses and inefficiency and heat. Stacking 3D packaging, which is kind of this holy grail of semiconductor packaging, it says, okay, instead you're all in an apartment building and you just take the elevator up. It's a much shorter distance. There's less heat, less loss, less resistance, but that's only enabled if you can make these tiny little straws and fill them with conductive metal.
It's hard to even conceptualize.
And yeah, it's too small.
Okay, so how do you charge by the atom or what? I mean, how do you charge? You can charge by the chip. I mean, essentially you're installing some sort of process that they use. So do you charge to license it? Do you charge to it? So how do you make money at this?
So in the semi industry, everything's done in a fab, which is in a clean room. It's very controlled. So we sell our equipment that allows them to do this process and do higher aspect ratio or do higher throughput. We sell them our equipment similar to a competitor's piece of equipment that won't be able to do all those things. And that gets installed in the clean room on their clusters and has to mate up with their control systems. It's a whole production.
Well, yeah. But clearly then, if you're selling the equipment, you got to build it first, hence the going public. But I mean, you got to raise a ton of money. What's it? Mm-hmm. You can't tell me exactly, but a piece of equipment must cost millions of dollars.
Yeah.
I guess on something like this, even if you're selling the equipment, I'm sure there's service, there's all kinds of other things that go with it that keeps a perpetual cash flowing. But on something this proprietary and this exciting, the margins must be okay.
It does depend. A lot of manufacturing has been driving towards cost reduction.
I know. That's why I'm asking. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like our equipment, we sell for the same price of a competitor's piece of ALD equipment, even though we could process 10 times the wafers. And the reason we do that is because when you say, hey, buy, they're looking for a car that's going to take them to A to B. And when you're in a B2B process, it doesn't necessarily matter if that car goes much faster than the other one that gets them to the same spot. So there's a lot more product development and customer development that we have to do to not only convey the value, but then prove it and show it. And then that value comes over time as we get more market share.
I would think as this becomes proven as the way to go, that you'll have a much better chance of much better opportunity to sell for what its full value is. Rather than just knocking off your competitor, you know, with a better product.
Yeah, we hope so too.
Yeah, I'm sure your investors too. All right, I want to switch entirely from the subject of the technology. I knew I was going to get just sucked into this, but and when we're done, I got one more question. When we're very done, but we're not. So talk about. I mean, you went from being a PhD student to having a PhD, but you're working in a lab. Now you become CEO of a company with just a few employees, and now you've got to see. Now you got 100 and some employees, right? So talk about that transition from being the scientist guy tinkerer, which you start out as, to being what you are now.
Yeah, and they, you know, if you read a lot of the books, it's often a difficult transition to go from kind of engineer founder or innovative founder to running a company. And we were just saying it's shifting from having a team of firefighters that know how to solve problems and innovate to more of a team that knows how to do the same thing over and over again, finding those small efficiencies. And it's a slightly different mindset. I think what has helped me to stay where I'm at and still enjoy it is just finding the innovation in every step of the process. You know, it's not always going back to my engineering roots and designing, you know, new valves or something, but it does when we get a process built out, an assembly line, and being able to innovate ways to do it better and better, you know, that's still very exciting for me.
Yeah. But as far as the leadership piece, I mean, to go from, I mean, let's face it, maybe you don't, but I would assume you know as much about this product and how it works and how it's built as anybody on the team. That's not your job anymore, right? Is it?
No, unfortunately.
Yeah. So talk about
usually
that.
If I go in the back, there's somebody watching to make sure I don't touch a wrench.
Yeah. So how does that, but mentally, like it's a mind shift.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. The things I do are more focused on what are the important things that have to get done within the company to keep it going so I can enable my team of people that are even smarter than I am to keep doing the innovating.
And that, is that true? If they were smarter, wouldn't they have been in that lab?
I think a lot of it is right time, right place.
Yeah.
And really in a lot of ways, probably being too stupid to know how hard it would be to start a company and go it on my own, you know?
Yeah. But you're not on your own now. Now you have investors and you know, it seems when investors get involved, and even good investors, their pace and their focus is often different from what might be comfortable for a technology-driven founder, right? So how do you talk about that? How do you deal with that and so forth?
Yeah, most of our early investors were actually strategics. And that, I think, was more beneficial than maybe your typical venture investor, because we were working with them on learning how to apply this to products, learning about the product cycle for them and how they think about going to market. So we were able to think a lot more about how this gets out into the market versus just, I've got a cool tech and I better make $100 million in revenue next year. Otherwise, you know, our funding's going.
Well, I was just talking to somebody not dissimilar from you, a guy who formed a new technology at CU and who had strategic investors, but the investment wasn't enough money from them. You're laughing. What am I going to say?
I mean, it's never enough money.
What I was going to say, it wasn't enough money from them to make them necessarily lean into deploying what they had invested in. They didn't have enough vested. And it was disappointing for him, because he was hoping that these strategic investors, right, were going to be leaning in with him. You haven't had that problem.
Well, yes and no. I think it was very good at highlighting, for instance, we have a number of car companies or companies that supply in that auto supply chain. It was, I think, valuable for us to learn early on how long it takes for a new technology to actually get into the supply chain for those companies.
But they also, So even though you're ready, they might not be. Even though they've invested to be alongside you, they might not be ready to just say, come on, we're ready too.
100%.
Wow, that must suck.
I mean, it allows you to learn and also readdress your thoughts on the market. Like I said, we target things like aerospace and defense, where higher performance is an absolute must have. And that tactical advantage of my battery lasts longer or it's safer, I can have more power. All of that is absolutely critical in those markets. And those are your first adopters. Any big company is rarely going to be a first adopter of new tech.
But you mentioned, these are government buyers in defense, aren't they traditionally, reputationally super slow?
They're trying not to be.
unless they need to solve a distinct problem right now.
Exactly.
Yeah, got it. All right, I want to go back to some of the founding stuff, because there's this notion of a valley of death that you've heard of, right? You've developed something that works in the lab, and you know it works, it's confident, but it's just like, well, maybe not just like, but I'm going to use this analogy anyway. A batch of cookies, you can make one or a small batch, and it's delicious, it's wonderful. You make 1,000 times, and they suck. So scaling is hard.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you guys manage that? Did you do in stages?
I mean, a lot of it was building the company. We bootstrapped the company for the first 6 years. So when we started it and we put some of our own money in, whatever small amount we scraped together as grad students, just to pay for patents and things. And then we built everything basically dumpster diving and eBaying, you know, pressure controllers and doing it as cheap as we could. Then we started doing consulting services, some demo and R&D development. And slowly we got to the point where we said, okay, if we need money to go to the next step, let's actually go look at raising capital. But I think part of what helped us across the valley of death was just finding ways. We've always made money, you know, maybe not profitably.
Yeah.
Until we took on investment, we were profitable. And then that extra burn to build the next size. That's what reduced profitability. So I think our approach was different than like the typical, you know, venture model of you're going to work on this thing. It was survival from day one. Mm. And then how can we move this to the next stage with the resources at hand?
Well, so what I'm wondering, when you say survival from day one and stuff, is like, can you, like, software is easy. You have a minimum viable product, right? I mean, when you're attracting investors before you actually can go to market, are these people so tech? I mean, you said that they're strategic partners, so they're pretty technically savvy, but did they really understand what you were doing?
I think from a technology standpoint, they did. From a market standpoint, they have their own agenda in terms of how can this be applied to our products,
yeah,
and weren't as concerned about how does Forge Nano turn their technology into products and sell to the whole market. So we had to do that part on our own, which was work with these companies, work on their products, and then keep an eye towards how can we advance this to other customers or other markets by incrementally, you know, growing our scale.
Was that hard? Was it hard to serve your investors and also look at the broader, longer range picture? Or did they, how well did those
Well, things? Yeah, it's typically an exercise in doing more with less for years.
God. And you're married with kids?
Yeah.
How did that all work out?
We met after I had started the company. So she kind of knew what she was getting into, and she's wonderful, and we have a really good balance on that allows me to do this and, you know, have a family.
I had a terrible balance when I had my company. I mean, 100-hour work week, sleeping at the office. Like, it was a terrible balance. And, you know, I've talked to my kids about it, and they're now grown, and, like, they don't remember it, but my wife does.
Yeah. You got that dad guilt that builds up.
At the time, no. I didn't have any guilt at the time. I was desperate to not go broke.
Yeah.
So there's no guilt. There's not room for guilt.
There you go.
You probably felt the same thing at Hunger. Like, I can't, no.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Early on, there would be, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. I remember going straight at that for about 4 months. And then I said, I got to take a day off. So I took a Sunday off, and my wife, we were dating at the time, I was like, what do you want to do? And she's like, oh, you're free. Okay. I'll cancel my plans. We'll find something to do.
Wow. Wow. All right. Before we wrap up, I want to mention, of course, Proco 360 focuses on world-class entrepreneurs who choose Colorado. You're based in Colorado. Your roots are CU Boulder. So how has Colorado played a role in what you've gotten accomplished so far?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a unique environment here. If you look at the top funded states, it's the coasts and then Colorado. And so it's a combination of, I think, our aerospace history, a combination of the national labs, the university systems. We just have a really high degree of technical competency out here, as well as maybe some more of that work-life balance that brings
that you've been describing.
Well, yeah, not in my case, but, you know, a lot of our employees might come from other states where there isn't the same opportunity to do something really impactful, but also go skiing on the weekend, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So now, as you think about, you're really changing the future of batteries and semiconductors both, allowing batteries to last longer, be more reliable, be safer and all that. Chips, you're allowing more to be stacked more powerfully than ever before with your technology. I mean, when you think about where the world's going, Is Nano Forge really, like, are you releasing all these technologies to, like, quantum leap?
I mean, that's how we feel. Eventually, not every market needs the absolute highest performance out of their product. And so atom by atom manufacturing maybe isn't a requirement. But more and more, as they get to that point, they come up against the inevitable barrier, which is single atom precision. So if you want the perfect performance and the perfect coating, you're going to have to eventually use ALD to get there. And we position ourselves to be the leader in scaling that and bringing new products to market.
Wow. I didn't realize that what you do enables batteries to be that much better. Where's the better market for you? Or is it both simultaneously?
You know, what we really found is it's always a function of how we approach the market. So batteries for electric vehicles, it takes so long, it's killed so many companies, but batteries for defense and aerospace is great for us. And we're getting on more and more satellite programs, more and more defense initiatives in semi, in a lot of ways, because there are other vendors and there are people know the technology. It's a little bit easier for us to go in and say, you know ALD, try ours, versus you have no idea what we're talking about, but this is a better end product.
Yeah.
And you got to be a little bit better at knowing the full vertical stack of that product because, you know, they're buying a full solution. So I'll say the industries that know what you do and buy what you sell are always a little easier than ones you have to evangelize.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. It makes perfect sense. And there's still the long sales cycle for the ones that need it. But yeah, it's hard to build a business based on that.
Oh, we've sold commercial tools to companies that make like the first new solid state rocket fuel of the last 60 years. Hmm. That company is using ALD to coat their product. It's not a huge market, but it's one where we had to build a relationship, develop the product, and then we just sold them a tool and a license to do it. And that we're happy to do that, especially in some of these markets that aren't going to necessarily ever be huge.
Yeah.
But they need better products.
Yes. And the adoption curve is quick.
It's much faster than
which is
the
great.
Really big ones.
Yeah. All right. Last question. Last conversation point. As you look back on all this experience, what story comes to mind that best captures sort of what makes you feel how you feel about it today?
That's an interesting question. Early on, we were taking on development projects, and that's where the engineering side of my brain, I just love that. Everything from magnets to rocket fuel to vaccines, you name it, we have taken programs on, we've upgraded, we've made better products. And these are all things that, while they're not, on the front burner, they're on the back burner, and we still get to innovate new things over and over again. That's what I think always got me excited, was making new things. And it's, even though we have a lot of focus now on the markets that we are, our battery factory is coming online in North Carolina. We have to be very focused, very disciplined. But at the end of the day, all of that still enables us to just make new, better products across all these great markets. And that, I can't imagine anything more fun or exciting than that.
That's cool. Well, let's wrap up with that. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and today on ProCode 360, you've been listening to my conversation with Paul Lichty of Forge Nano. Paul, it's great to have you on ProCode 360. Thanks for explaining things the best you could.
It was great talking to you.
I will never fully understand what you do, but I'm so impressed with it. So it's going to be cool to watch batteries get more efficient, chips more powerful. So that's amazing. Listeners, glad you're here on ProCode 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you and I and my guests can be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. You make the show successful by subscribing to the ProCode 360 podcast. If you haven't yet, it's a huge help if you submit a review in your app. Thanks again to show sponsors, Via Technologies and Denver Ventures. That's the show. Live, work, love Colorado.